From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, September 19th, 2016. And on this day, an Arizona-based company purchases Fairchild Semiconductor for $2.4 billion, leaving the fate of the South Portland facility and its hundreds of workers unclear. Mainers rally in Bangor to support efforts to repeal provisions of the Social Security formula that they say prevent retired public servants from receiving their full benefits. And as Maine voters decide whether to legalize recreational marijuana, we begin a 7-part series on the issue with a look at how legalization has played out in Colorado. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th, kvcc.me.edu.
I'm Barbara Caridi. An Arizona-based company has purchased Fairchild Semiconductor for $2.4 billion. As Patty White reports, the merger is expected to provide millions in cost savings for ON Semiconductor, but the fate of Fairchild's South Portland facility is unclear.
This acquisition has been in the works since last November, but it's taken months for ON Semiconductor to get the necessary regulatory approvals. Last week, the company got final clearance. In a conference call with investors on Monday, ON Semiconductor President Keith Jackson welcomed Fairchild employees.
I am confident that the immense talent and dedication of our newest employees will accelerate our progress towards building a world-class power management company.
Jackson says the merger will not only create a strong leader in the semiconductor industry, it will also translate into overall cost savings for the company, $160 million in the first 18 months and $225 million by the end of 2019.
This is what's been happening in the semiconductor industry for about the last 2 years or so.
Ian Ng is a semiconductor industry analyst from MKM Partners in Connecticut.
Companies are, instead of, you know, growing organically, growing their existing businesses and getting revenue and earnings growth, they're finding that it's actually easier or a better path to acquire other companies, get some of the scale and synergies that way.
It's unclear how the acquisition will affect Fairchild's manufacturing facility in South Portland. According to the Maine Department of Labor, Fairchild is the 24th largest employer in Cumberland County, with between 501 and 1,000 employees. But analyst Ian Ng says given that the projected cost savings are more on the operations side, $120 million versus $30 million for the manufacturing side, it may be a good sign for the South Portland facility.
It's more on the headcount side than the operating assets. So it's possible that they keep some of the manufacturing assets going forward.
South Portland Assistant City Manager Joshua Rennie says he's also optimistic about the future of ON Semiconductor in Maine.
We have no indication that anything is going to change, but we're looking forward to meeting with the new company officials and the current management staff and learning more.
Analyst Ian Ng says the two semiconductor companies complement each other. ON offers products to a broad range of markets, from automotive to industrial to communications, while Fairchild's focus is on power. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Meanwhile, in Bangor today, dozens of Mainers rallied at the local office of 2nd District Congressman Bruce Poliquin to voice support for his efforts to repeal two provisions of the Social Security formula. Poliquin and others say both are preventing retired public servants, such as firefighters, teachers, and police officers, from receiving their full Social Security benefits. The two 30-year-old benefit reduction rules, originally intended to prevent double dipping by workers with public and private sector experience, could be shelved by Congress next year. Poliquin is among a bipartisan group of lawmakers calling for changes to protect more than 2 million Americans who face huge cuts in their Social Security benefits simply because they worked in government jobs that come with a pension.
How unfair it has been to them to work very diligently in serving our communities and also during their working years working in the private sector. and paying into the Social Security system and doing this diligently and paying the taxes they're supposed to pay. And then all of a sudden when they retire, they realize sometimes for the first time that they won't get their full Social Security benefits. This is absolutely unfair, and it's got to be fixed.
The two rules creating most of the heartburn for workers with a mix of private and public sector experience are the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. Bob Alexander, an employee of the Bangor Housing Authority, says that under the rules, he is 1 year shy of receiving his full benefits.
I'm one of those people who worked most of my career under Social Security. I have 29 years of what they call substantial earnings. And the way the rules are, if you have 30 countable years, you don't lose any of your Social Security. Somehow I have 29. So because of that 29 instead of 30, it cost me over $200 a month for the rest of my life.
Many of the workers affected by the rules who attended Poliquin's rally were police officers, firefighters, and teachers. Poliquin also addressed this weekend's terror attacks in New York, New Jersey, and Minnesota. The 2nd District Republican said that as a member of the House Task Force to investigate terrorism financing, he'll press for greater scrutiny of immigrants.
This was another terrorist attack, or maybe two or three separate terrorist attacks on our homeland. And that's why I have spoken up very clearly to make sure we don't let anybody in this country unless we know who they are. And one of the problems about admitting folks in the Middle East is a lot of times there are no databases, so we don't know where they worked, what organizations they belong to, and so forth and so on.
Poliquin said he's urging anyone with any information about the attacks to contact the FBI. Ahmad Khan Rahami of Elizabeth, New Jersey, was taken into custody in connection with the bomb blasts in Manhattan and New Jersey. But police said he was not on any federal terror watch list. Police also say they did not believe the naturalized 28-year-old Afghanistan native was part of a terror cell. Meanwhile, in Vassalboro last week, 8 new state troopers were sworn in at ceremonies at the Maine Criminal Justice Academy. But as Mal Leary reports, that has done little to ease the shortage of troopers at the Maine State Police.
Lawmakers gave pay raises ranging from 12% to 18% to troopers after they were convinced the state police were not competitive with other law enforcement agencies. Colonel Robert Williams, chief of the Maine State Police, says those raises went into effect in July, and he won't know if they've helped with filling vacancies until another training academy meets in January. He hopes so, because there are currently 28 vacancies. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, attorneys general or their representatives from 46 states will be in Portland tomorrow for the 6th triennial conference on the 1998 tobacco settlement agreement. Maine Attorney General Janet Mills is hosting the gathering. Mills says among the issues attendees will be looking at are the health aspects of smoking, trends in youth smoking, whether or not the settlement agreement continues to fund anti-smoking programs, and more.
Looking at how tobacco products are marketed and endorsed on social media. Looking at e-cigarettes as the newest challenge for health policy people.
Under the terms of the so-called Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, Maine and 45 other states are receiving ongoing annual cash payments from tobacco companies. In exchange, the states agreed to drop lawsuits seeking to recover costs incurred by the state for the treatment of tobacco-related illnesses. The settlement also imposed restrictions on tobacco company advertising and marketing. Coming up, we begin a 7-part series on Question 1 on the November ballot with a look at how legalizing recreational marijuana has played out in the state of Colorado. When it comes to marijuana, Maine has historically been on the permissive side. It was one of the first states to decriminalize penalties for possession back in the 1970s and one of the first to authorize medical marijuana in the late 90s. 3 years ago, Portland became the first city on the East Coast to legalize recreational use for adults. This fall, voters statewide are being asked to follow Portland's lead. Passage of Question 1 on the ballot would establish a framework to distribute, tax, and regulate the sale of marijuana and marijuana. marijuana products to adults age 21 and over. All this week, we're undertaking a closer look at the issue with a series of reports called High Stakes, How Legalizing Marijuana Could Affect Maine. Today, in Part 1, Steve Mistler looks at what Maine might learn from Colorado's experience.
So, are you here for the recreational?
I am.
Okay.
Colorado residents and tourists first went shopping for legal pot 2 years ago, on New Year's Day. They flooded shops like Northern Lights Cannabis Company, one of five retail stores in Edgewater, a small city located just west of Denver. This man has already bought a half ounce of a strain called Apollo 11.
Did you want to see anything else?
Yeah, I was also interested in Kaboom.
Okay.
Kaboom is a featured strain at Northern Lights. It's described as fast-paced, perfect to get things done. At first glance, Kaboom seems like the perfect metaphor for the Colorado cannabis industry. Marijuana sales exploded to nearly $1 billion last year, an increase of more than 40% from 2 years ago. The state collected $135 million in taxes and fees, much of it earmarked for school projects. And the combined local tax revenue from pot businesses like Northern Lights is helping to get things done, including a $7 million civic center. But it wasn't an instant success.
This is not like a light switch. You don't just decide to turn a system on kind of this magnitude without a lot of really critical thought of how you're going to do it.
Andrew Friedman was appointed as Colorado's pot czar by Governor John Hickenlooper. His job is to help agencies coordinate the state's implementation of the legalization law. Friedman is 33 years old. He says he neither expected nor sought this job. But that, from Hickenlooper's perspective, made Friedman the right choice. Colorado needed a fresh face, someone who could bring together the warring factions and help construct a $30 million regulatory apparatus.
There's a whole bunch of people who've wanted this for a long time and really have gone to war with the other side and don't trust them still.
It was a massive effort, one Friedman compared to building an airplane while it's still flying. There's been turbulence. 3 months after retail sales began in Colorado, the Denver Post reported some retailers' edible marijuana products did not contain the amount of THC advertised on the package. Some people got sick, others got ripped off, but there were few consequences. That's because adequate product testing and penalties against manufacturers hadn't been fully implemented.
We truly had no guidelines to do this, no roadmap to go from. It was, I think, the rarest thing to happen in state government is to truly be creating something from scratch.
The state's legislature scrambled to keep up. It's passed dozens of bills to fill the gaps or fix problems not considered by the citizen-initiated law. Maine will need to create a similar regulatory system, also from scratch. But David Boyer, who manages the legalization campaign here, says the cost will bring a significant return on investment.
Revenue has exceeded expectations in Colorado, right? So this is millions and millions of dollars that Maine is flushing down the drain. It's here. It's just not going to the state. It's not going to the legitimate businesses.
The campaign's political director, Alicia Melnick, says taxing marijuana sales should more than pay for the new regulatory system. In Colorado, the state collected over $135 million in taxes and fees last year, and it costs about $30 million to regulate the pot industry there. And Melnick says Maine could see other social benefits, such as freeing up police to work on problems more pressing than marijuana.
It's about reserving our criminal laws for the type of acts that actually threaten our communities.
Arrests for marijuana-related offenses have plummeted by nearly 50% since Colorado legalized pot. Possession charges dropped by nearly 90%. But unlike Maine, Colorado had never decriminalized possession charges in the first place. And pot czar Andrew Friedman says other problems have surfaced, including the emergence of a shadow market. That's where people are legally growing, but illegally selling the product out of state. It's a lucrative business, and Friedman worries that it will undercut the regulated industry.
This home grow situation really has started to get out of control, and we really are seeing kind of the criminal element come into Colorado and grow at home.
And public safety concerns remain in Colorado. 70% of the state's cities and towns have banned commercial operations by ordinance, an option that would also be open to Maine communities under question one. But Melnick, with the Maine campaign, says it's clear that Colorado does not have, quote, buyer's remorse. And she says people are looking west to see the future of pot. Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer agrees.
There's 80 million people who are going to be voting on some form of legalization this year.
Blumenauer says if more states legalize, Congress could be prompted to lift the federal prohibition. This year, Maine and Massachusetts are poised to become the first states in the Northeast to legalize recreational use. California could join the four other western states to create a legalized bloc. And Florida could join 24 other states, including Maine, that allow medicinal marijuana.
If several of them pass, which looks like the case, I think that'll be the tipping point for Congress. This is the year where the movement is cresting.
Mainers will decide whether they want to ride the wave when they go to the polls November 8th. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Meanwhile, a group of business professionals has formed a new coalition to advocate for better regulation of the marijuana industry. Maine Professionals for Regulating Marijuana is not taking a position on question one on the November ballot. Their members are equally divided. But as Susan Sharon reports, the group hopes to have a better system in place if the measure passes.
The group includes accountants, realtors, attorneys, municipal officials, and marijuana dispensaries. They describe themselves as members of the business community who say they want to see the best rules in place for Maine's existing medical marijuana program and for recreational marijuana if Maine voters approve its use. Toby McGrath is the group's president.
Most of this is an acknowledgement that we do have a current medicinal marijuana industry here in Maine that can use some tightening. But also if question one passes, that the rules are promulgated in an appropriate fashion that would make sure that we're focused on quality, safety, and transparency here in Maine.
For example, McGrath says both medicinal and recreational adult use of marijuana require mandatory safety and potency testing and labeling. The group also wants to see more stringent record keeping, a ban on advertising to minors, and child-resistant packaging. Pete Dufour, a Portland-based accountant, says he joined the group in part because he's heard from clients who are legally involved in the medical marijuana industry but having trouble accessing professional financial services.
The state laws are pretty clear, and people are still learning how they apply, but given the reluctance of the federal government to sanction many of the activities in the marijuana space, a lot of professional advisors are reluctant to get involved.
Even though marijuana remains outlawed at the federal level, Dufour says it's time for Maine's business community to discuss these issues and work with people who deserve their help. In 2014, Maine's medical marijuana program was estimated to have generated at least $60 million worth of revenue and about $4 million in taxes to the state. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And in Unity this weekend, Mainers will gather for the 40th time to celebrate rural living. The Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association is hosting the Common Ground Country Fair at its Unity home and is expecting about 60,000 people to participate in the three-day festival. The event includes demonstrations and exhibits about environmentally sustainable living and will feature talks on everything from transforming the food supply chain to reading a horse's body language and learning Native American children's games. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
The autumnal equinox approaches while temperatures are anything but similar this week. In fact, Portland may establish a new record warm minimum temperature for the date. What showers exist will slowly dry out tonight. Clouds will break late with regions of dense fog. Very clammy and mild, mid-50s north, low 60s south. Following a dash of morning sun, showers will return along the Quebec border tomorrow. Partly cloudy, the foothills, Bangor, Topsfield. Mostly sunny farther south. Still quite humid across the southern half of Maine. Mid-70s north through upper 80s south. Drier air will arrive at last Wednesday. Partly cloudy throughout the mountains in the county. Mostly sunny for the majority of Maine. Low 70s to low 80s north to south. Expect variable sunshine Thursday, brightest far north, with a possible mountain shower late. Wide range in temperatures. Mid-60s north, 80s south. Cooler along the coast. The most potent cool front since early June will be plunging towards Maine Friday. Showers all day north, but not arriving until late Portland-Kennebunk. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Monday, September 19th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Patty White, A.J. Higgins, Steve Missler, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.